This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hees Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
an official with the International Committee for the Red Cross says rapid humanitarian response in Somalia is having an impact, but the needs remain great. Severe drought in the region has left as much as half of Somalia's population, or about 6 million people, in need for food and medical assistance.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, the UN says there is an upsurge in violence in Central African Republic, and there are now 29 suspected cases of Ebola in remote northern DRC.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, an official with the International Committee of the Red Cross says rapid humanitarian response in Somalia is having an impact, but the needs remain great. Severe drought in the region has left as much as half of Somalia's population, or about 6 million people, in need for food and medical assistance. Mohamed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
The Geneva-based organization ICRC is working with the Somali Red Crescent Society to reach close to 1 million people affected by drought across Somalia. Speaking to reporters Friday in Nairobi after his tour in southern and central Somalia, ICRC Director of Global Operations, Dominic Stillhart, says the situation is stabilizing in towns like Baidoa, but not in the rural areas.
Most of the people are coming from outside, rather than from Baidoa itself, shows that out there the situation is more critical than in urban areas. But at the same time, it is also more challenging, of course, to cover a wider area with food and cash transfers than to do something like this for 150,000 internally displaced in an urban center such as Baidoa.
Children remain at particular risk. ICRC says its clinics nationwide are treating nearly twice as many malnourished children as they were a year ago. In 2011, famine claimed the lives of a quarter of a million people in Somalia. Stillhart says the humanitarian response to the crisis this year has been faster. But the work is far from over. The return of rainfall to some parts of Somalia in recent weeks has raised hopes.
Even if the rains are good, this is not going to change the situation immediately. There will be significant needs in terms of strengthening the livelihoods and the resilience of people over a period of time. And this is also where, of course, it is important that donors support organizations like the ICRC, but also others, in order to ensure that we can build the resilience of the people who will continue to be exposed by shocks, especially in Somalia, every year.
The UN says an additional $831 million in humanitarian funding for Somalia is needed this year. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohamed. The World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization warn the humanitarian crisis is escalating not only in Somalia but two other African countries as well as Yemen. At a press conference in Rome yesterday, the UN organizations said millions of people do not have enough food to eat and children are especially suffering. Reporter Josephine McKenna attended the press conference and provides us with details.
These two UN organizations, the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization, are on the front line fighting what is a huge humanitarian crisis. And they wanted to hold this press conference to draw attention in particular to what's happening in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia and Yemen.
They also looked at Northeast Nigeria as a region of being of great concern. Why is that?
Well, they first of all said that 10 of the 13 biggest food crises in the world are about conflict. And one of the areas of particular concern is Northeast Nigeria. Denise Brown, who is in charge of the emergency response at the World Food Programme, said the World Food Programme was not prepared for the levels of human suffering that they are seeing in that area. The conflict has been going on for 4 years, as we know. Boko Haram is very active in that region. But she said this is a problem that was centered in northeast Nigeria and, as we know, is now spilling over into other countries. So as she said, this was the epicenter in northeast Nigeria. But now that people are being displaced, it's becoming an enormous regional challenge as people are forced to flee their homes and this spills over into neighbouring countries. The World Food Programme estimates more than 5 million people are food insecure in Nigeria, not enough food on a daily basis. And Denise Brown from WFP said it's as if 2 million people are perched on the edge of a cliff. And it's not just about food, it's about health, sanitation, concern about some of the poorest people on the planet and how we're going to help them survive in the coming months.
Also, just touching briefly on Somalia, what did they say about lessons learned from back in 2010-2011?
Well, as we know, Somalia had a severe famine in 2010-2011. The UN agency said they perhaps declared the emergency, the famine, a little too late, in the sense that once it was declared, countries were reluctant to get involved. They were concerned about the Islamic militants. 250,000 people are estimated to have died. Now the UN agencies believe they need to be on the front foot. They need to be letting people know the state of these emergencies. And Somalia is another country that they're particularly concerned about at the moment. They estimate that 3.2 million people are what they call food insecure. They don't have enough to eat. And well, at least WFP, the agency that delivers food and handles the immediate response, is aiming to get to 3.5 million people in 2017 in Somalia alone.
Also, in looking at all of four countries, Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, humanitarian agencies are now in emergency response mode. What do they say lies ahead for the future?
Well, there's great concern because the number of emergencies appears to be increasing, not only in Africa, but we still have the Syrian emergency in Syria and the number of people that are being forced to leave and immigrate to other countries. These agencies are really stretched financially, so they're looking for more contributions, donor aid from wealthy donors, corporate or government donors, and they're also looking for public donations. And another example that they gave is that 800,000 refugees have been forced to leave South Sudan and are now moving into Uganda. So that emergency is spilling over into neighbouring countries that can't necessarily cope with the scale of the crisis either.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with me from Rome.
In the Gambia, arrest warrants have been issued for two former security officers in the 2004 death of an outspoken newspaper editor. Deida Haidara was the co-owner and editor of the independent newspaper The Point. He was highly critical of the ruler, Yahya Jammeh, and the imposition of tough media laws. Haidara was shot dead in December 2004. Now that Gambia has a new president, Adama Barrow, suspects in the journalist's death are being sought. Vandera Mbai, founder of the online Freedom newspaper, was a colleague of Haidara. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
I get to know Deida Haidara back in the 90s when I started as a journalist. He groomed me into the profession. Deida is very straightforward and committed to reporting the truth, speak truth to power. As you may know, Deputy Jammeh came to power through coup d'etat in July of 1994. So Deida's main preoccupation at the time was to write critical editorials to address the excesses of the military junta. When the government came up with the idea to pass a media commission bill to regulate the private press, Deida was opposed to it. I used to work at his newspaper called The Point newspaper. He was killed in 2004 for basically speaking out. He said the law was meant to kill private press in the Gambia, to kill independent press in the Gambia.
Now, Pandiri, it was alleged that there was government involvement in his death, but that was back in 2004, and now arrest warrants are being issued for two former security officials. How did that come about?
Yes, on Thursday, a magistrate court in Banjul issued a warrant against two former members of Dictator Jammeh's constituted assassin team. Major Sana Manjang, who is believed to be at large, and Kausu Kamara, a former colonel who was commanding Mr. Janme's assassin team. The court has instructed the police to work with Interpol to effect the arrest of Mr. Manjang and Kausu Kamara.
Now, on another matter in the Gambia, I understand the opposition is going to court to try to overturn an old law relating to public address systems. Would you explain?
The minister in charge of foreign affairs, Hussein Dabo, who is also the leader of the main opposition, United Democratic Party, has filed a lawsuit before the Supreme Court, together with dozens of plaintiffs, saying that the Supreme Court should declare the Public Order Act unconstitutional. The Public Order Act is an old law, colonial law, incorporated into the Gambian Constitution. So Mr. Dabo is saying that the law will undermine the basic liberties and freedoms of Gambians, the right to assemble, the right to protest. Dabo is saying that that part of the law should be expunged from the books of the Gambia. Mr. Dabo happens to be a victim of the Public Order Act. He was jailed back in 2014 together with his party officials for organizing a procession without permits.
Now, on another matter, people who say they were victims of the abuse of former leader Yahya Jammeh are getting together to tell their stories. What's going on?
There's a committee called Victims of Yahya Jammeh's Government. Mr. Milo Toure, a Gambian-American, is the chairperson of this organization. Basically, what they're saying is that they will help the victims in terms of counseling, in terms of medical support, in terms of preparing them ahead of the upcoming Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Some of these victims are saying that they want justice, they want the government to ensure that dictator Yahya Jammeh is extradited, prosecuted. Some of the victims explain how their loved ones were abducted, how their loved ones were killed by the Gambian state under the orders of dictator Yahya Jammeh.
That's Panderi Mbai, founder of the online Freedom newspaper. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa. In related news, the Gambian government is also seeking the extradition from Switzerland of former Interior Minister Osman Sonko for alleged crimes against civilians.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report by UNICEF says at least 300,000 unaccompanied or separated children were recorded in the last 2 years worldwide, five times as many as in 2010. Tens of thousands of those children are estimated to be from Africa. Many have been separated from their families by smugglers or traffickers as they migrate to Europe and other regions where there's the potential for work. Many adults and parents are separated even in Europe as they are processed for refugee status. Patrick Rose is UNICEF's Crisis Communications Specialist for West and Central Africa, based in Dakar, Senegal. He told reporter William Eagle that UNICEF is calling on world leaders to work to alleviate the plight of unaccompanied children and refugees.
There are really tangible steps that world leaders, especially as they gather at the G20, can start to consider and start to take action on, because we're dealing with an unprecedented movement of people. And, of course, by logical extension, that's an unprecedented movement of children. And what we're finding is that our international system, our international laws, our international leaders are not really doing everything that can be done to protect these children.
Patrick, what are some of the steps that UNICEF has in mind that they would like the G20 and other countries to consider?
I think the first and foremost is to consider all children as children. Let's remove the label illegal or migrant children or sort of refugee children. Let's really see them for what they are, which is children just like our own children. And once you start from that point of view, well, then the idea of holding them in detention or putting them in prison cells or sort of subjecting them to a whole series of traumatic interviews, trying to just access what is a basic human right, after all, the free movement of people and access to education, access to being a healthy human being. And that's all these children are looking for. But really, more holistically, how do we get these children to feel happy where they are? We do need to be building up education opportunities in these countries. If you look at some of the source countries like Gambia or Mali or even here in Senegal, you know, children are leaving partly for economic opportunities, but they just want a better education. And what they're frustrated by is that the systems here that are available to them are not the education that they're looking for.
UNICEF has also talked about the importance of keeping families together if and when they are going to migrate.
There are special streams within a sort of a processing system for children, and there's special streams for men and for women and so on. And obviously, it was sort of born out of a fundamental logistic simplicity in terms of providing the needs of children altogether is easier for people who are running these kinds of detention centers than it is to sort of have a very mixed population altogether. But I think that we absolutely need to see families stick together.
Patrick, are you saying that the children are often separated from their families once they've arrived in Europe by established bureaucratic systems?
There's a range of different mechanisms, and I think that one of the things that we're calling for here is just a more coordinated approach and one that puts this centrality of a family at the heart of it. And that takes more time, perhaps, to design a system like that. Systems should be designed that keep the child's well-being at its center, and that means keeping the systems designed so that the children stay with their families.
You mentioned that there are some systems where this is being done successfully. Can you give me an example?
Well, we know that in Italy, as recently as only 2 months ago, they've taken some very sort of active steps and have made some pledges to ensure that the children are not held in sort of any sort of detention situation.
UNICEF has made several recommendations for the G20, including a call for the protection of child refugees from exploitation and violence. But how can that be done, especially on a very long trip, often to Libya and then to Europe? Can the routes be monitored in some way by the international community?
This is an evolving question and an evolving response. These are extremely dangerous areas, especially when we look at sort of northeastern Niger and southern Libya. We are definitely dealing with areas that are beyond the reach of any sort of local state control. And definitely, you know, it's that degree of lack of control that's created the culture of impunity. And that needs the world leaders to get serious about supporting a state structure in Libya or in any state that sort of has areas beyond its control. And the only way that our current international architecture works is if states actually do control the territory that they claim. And when we start to see large parts of Libya that are under control of bandits that have no consequences for, you know, massive human rights violations, then we start to see these kinds of massive children's rights violations.
That was Patrick Rose of UNICEF in Dakar, Senegal. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
There are now 29 suspected cases of Ebola in remote northern DRC. The World Health Organization updated the figure today, reflecting an increase of 9 since yesterday. The figure also includes 2 laboratory-confirmed deaths of Ebola. The WHO says it probably won't know for several weeks what the full extent of the outbreak is. Health officials are trying to find more than 400 people who may have come in contact with those who are infected.
And one of the researchers who discovered the Ebola virus in 1976 and helped name it after an African is following developments in the DRC. Dr. Malanga Miatudila is currently a consultant since retiring from the World Bank in 2005. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the DRC outbreak.
My first reaction is that this is something we should expect, although we don't know when and where the next blow will come. Because, unfortunately, we have to live with the Ebola virus, because Ebola is in our African forest across the equator. So Congo being the largest country in that area, so we should expect DRC to be hit more often than the other countries. The problem really is that we human beings are encroaching in ecosystem where we are supposed not to be.
Are we encountering Ebola reservoirs in gorillas or chimpanzees or bats? Do we know?
Yes. What we think we have discovered is that the virus live in good term with some bats. And then, accidentally, we come in contact with those bats, because in this area, unfortunately, people seem to love bat meat. This is how the infection gets into the human community. Sometimes the infection is indirect, because maybe another animal has been infected by the bats, like antelopes when they eat droplings from bats, or sometimes monkeys, because monkeys, they do eat bats, so they get infected. And people sometimes, they go and get this bush meat.
Now, you've talked about encroaching into areas we have not encroached before, and Ebola is one of the results from that. Do you see other diseases or viruses emerging that we have not seen before?
Oh, yes, yes. So we have to expect that. We have to be ready for new emerging diseases. That for sure. That's for sure. Especially in the African forest, you know that we have thousands of species, both vegetal and animal, that are not known yet. So we should be expecting to encounter new friends.
Having seen what happened in West Africa just a few years ago, what lessons were learned that can be applied to the outbreak in the northern DRC?
Okay. What happened in West Africa is that they didn't follow the recipe that has been developed in earlier outbreaks. To fight Ebola, first, you have to have rapid response. And then, two, you have to rely on local communities. Anybody coming from outside should see himself as supporting the local people. What happened in West Africa last time? First, denial. They thought that they were living outside the Ebola area. That's the first thing, denial. And second, when they were forced to admit the existence of Ebola, the response was very, very, very slow. It took them more than 6 months to start responding to the outbreak. And third mistake, they thought that Ebola was a medical problem, a problem to be tackled by experts from outside. So they will ask people not to do anything, but to just wait for them to come, these experts. So these three mistakes explain why in West Africa, Ebola could survive more than 12 months and kill more people. And now we are afraid, because this is the first time where Ebola had the opportunity to pass through many, 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 many patients. So that means Ebola has learned how to defend itself against a human being. So maybe in West Africa now we are dealing with an improved virus or more efficient virus.
Doctor, would you like to add anything more about the outbreak in the DRC?
I am afraid that this problem can derail us from our real problems. Since 1976 up to today, Ebola has killed 953 people in DRC. Very, very little compared to the number of deaths due to malaria. Yes, we have to fight Ebola. So we have very simple technology to control Ebola. So please, we should not be distracted from malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, diarrheal diseases, and things like that.
That's Dr. Malanga Miatudila, one of the researchers who discovered the Ebola virus in 1976. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com.
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.